Hello there. We're trying to keep Choral Chihuahua going, and so we draw your attention to the possibility of listening to us on Patreon for just a few quid a month. This also magically gets rid of the ads. That's Patreon with an E, patreon.com/choralchihuahua. On with the app.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Hello, and welcome to another edition of Choral Chihuahua. We're here today with Robert. Hello, Robert.
Hello, hello.
And with Canon Dr. Victoria Johnson, who is currently precentor at York Minster. Without too much further ado, verbum chihuahua factum est. Victoria, please say the words.
Welcome to Choral Chihuahua.
It's a Morales thing.
Victoria, can you just quickly summon up what Lent is and what's it for? How does it fit into the Christian calendar and message?
So it's a season in the Christian year, and it's a season which remembers the experience of Jesus in the wilderness for 40 days when he was tested and tempted by the devil, by power and wealth and status. So in terms of the lived out Christian life, it's a period of penitence, of reflection, of fasting. The word Lent means sort of lengthening, so it parallels with spring and the coming of spring and the preparations for Holy Week and Easter, which is really what it's about. We're kind of preparing hearts and minds for Easter. So it's that kind of a period of journey, of sort of reflection, of contemplation. That's a good way of putting it.
I can see we're going to need the etymology corner jingle in this episode more than once, I think, but we'll save it for a little later.
Well, the slightly spurious thing about Lent is, of course, that it's English for fast and French for slow. but let's go straight to the first track, shall we? It's in honour of our special guest. This is The Lamentation by Sir Edward Burstow, a long time of York Minster, one of my favourite composers who shares a name with a cricket player. And Victoria, before we hear this, could you just tell us a little bit about the nature of the Lamentation text?
Yeah, the Lamentation text comes from the book of the prophet Jeremiah, from the Hebrew scriptures or the Old Testament. So probably written about 2,500 years ago, the text of this piece of music. And in a sense, I think these words were meant to be sung. When they were written, they're written as a kind of funeral dirge or lament, a sort of longing for restoration and renewal. So that's the sort of origin of the words of the text. And of course, Burstow is so significant in the life of York Minster. We sing the Lamentations, we'll be singing this Sunday in the service of Choral Matins in place of one of the other canticles that we might sing specifically in Lent. So a great piece of music. And of course, I'm biased. It sounds absolutely fantastic in the acoustics of York Minster.
All together now. How doth the city sit solitary that was full of people? But all I'm thinking of is the suspension.
That was great among the men.
are, that we're singing along here in the deluxe Choral Chihuahua studio. Those suspensions. The trouble is, it's so rich musically, and that's not what Lent is about. Well, or maybe it is. We'll talk about it. But I have such memories of those, and the Bishop of Hereford appearing afterwards with Easter eggs. It was a chorister thing. Gosh, that's taken me back. And what a shame not to play the whole thing. The Choir of York Minster there, conducted by Philip Moore in York Minster. Victoria, you're not at York for very much longer. You're off to Cambridge to take up a new post at St John's College, where I failed to get in. Yeah, I applied to George Guest and I applied for 2 years at once, which meant he was meant to give me a little bit of extra time. And he said, well, Mr. Honeyworth, I see you've applied for both 1984 and 1985, so I'm supposed to give you a little bit more time. But in your case, I can't really see the point. Which told me, I think. But you have a really varied background. I mean, you're a research scientist. Just give us as well, or in your past, I mean, how you come to draw all these different things together?
Oh, well, music and liturgy have been part of my life from being a kid. I sang in the church choir. I learnt the organ. But in school life, my dad was like, you need a proper job. So I was kind of good at science. So I went into science, worked in a lab, did research, cancer research. But, you know, it gets you in the end, doesn't it? Music and liturgy and worship. And God gets you in the end, in my case. So I got ordained. And I've spent 4 amazing years working here at York Minster as precentor, so helping oversee the music and the worship. And I'm going to be Dean of St John's College, Cambridge, so also working with fantastic musicians, with Christopher Gray there, the choristers, the choir, and being embedded in that learning community. So I'm quite excited, absolutely sort of sad and devastated to be leaving York, but a sort of once-in-a-lifetime opportunity, I think, that I couldn't resist.
I was struck by that line in your biography about moving to the learning environment. You are a lifelong learner, aren't you?
Yeah, some people would say I'm a bit of a nerd, but I like to, I just love learning. I love the opportunity to learn and develop and grow and think about new things. A very Lenten theme, actually, learning and studying and learning about yourself and the world you live in. So, yeah, I'm kind of hooked on learning and helping other people learn. So I teach as well. So that's important to me. So all of that opens up at St John's in Cambridge.
And I was struck just reading a little bit that about how science might inform and kind of enrich your own faith and your own approach to religion. Can you tell us a bit about that?
Yeah, it's about the inquisitiveness, I suppose, of life, learning about the world we live in. What's this made of? How does it work? How do we interact with things? So I've always had that inquisitive nature. For me, unless your faith is asking questions, it's a bit of a dead faith. So you're kind of constantly exploring and asking questions about the world you live in. So that's how I've sort of navigated my own faith journey. And some of that comes into music and worship. So I'm a bit obsessed with acoustics. So working in York Minster is kind of a great place to sort of figure that out. I think actually Bairstow was quite obsessed with acoustics. I think there's lots of stories in the sort of legend of Sir Edward Bairstow that he understood the acoustics of York Minster and wrote music which matched the acoustics of the building. So I am a little bit obsessed about the science behind speech and song and acoustics and music.
That's quite interesting, because the work that Helena Daffin and Jude Brierton do up at the university in creating virtual acoustics, I met a PhD student of theirs recently, of Jude's, that's working on the different acoustics of Notre Dame Cathedral, which they're kind of part recreating. How do different Christian churches have different attitudes to Lent? Are there things that are different in the Orthodox faith from the Catholic to the Protestant?
I think across the whole Christian tradition, there are different ways of approaching Lent. So there's across the traditions, I think there is a sense of fasting, of prayer, of kind of self-reflection and penitence. And all of those things work themselves out in different ways. So in my part of the church, the music might be the best way I describe it to sort of people who are new to it is we're more in a minor key in Lent. So you're not going to be singing very joyful and exuberant music because the whole thing is pared down. And I think probably throughout history, Lent would might have been a time when you'd have dispensed with other instruments and just gone right back to the voice. And some of the music that we think about is in that kind of genre, just a cappella music without adornment. So the liturgies and the sort of space of churches becomes much more simple. No flowers, no kind of big banners and glitz. It's all very kind of pared back and simple. And obviously, many Christian traditions have the fasting element. But the fasting, you know, it's not just a diet. It's actually focusing your mind and your body on what you should be doing. So Lent is really a period, I think, for turning yourself around. Turning yourself to God is what we'd say in the church. Learning to live a better life, stop being so petty and sorting yourself out so that you can live a better life in the world and be a nicer person.
The etymology of penitent?
Etymology corner.
Oh, well, this is the best bit. The etymology of penitent, I describe it as turning, a change. A change in direction. I think some of the phrase comes from the Greek metanoia, which is about changing direction, turning around. So you can see the whole season is a season of transformation. We're getting ready, in effect, for a whole celebration on Easter Day, a new beginning, a new start. So quite self-reflective. I mean, quite appropriate to the contemporary life, a period of self-reflection and renewal.
And that turning that's the final line of one of the Lamentations, isn't it? Jerusalem, Jerusalem, turn thyself unto God. It's so completely different approaches that we have in the burst to what we have in the next track. But that sense of orienting ourselves in the right way seems such an important thing. And part of, can you tell us a little bit about the idea of perhaps denial or like you say, reduction to the necessities that happens in Lent, and maybe a little bit about how that might happen in other religions too? Are there any kind of analogous things?
Yeah, there are parallels in other major world religions. The most obvious parallel is Ramadan, which is a period of fasting in Islam. But I think it all comes down to the same thing, which is a sort of an internal kind of cleansing, so you can turn and live a new kind of life. And I think that parallels across world religions in different ways and is played out in slightly different ways within the Christian religion itself.
Kind of spiritual detox.
Nice.
There would be letters if we didn't play some of the Talis Lamentations at this point. I mean, we could have played the Allegri Miserere, of course, although which Allegri Miserere then would we get on to? These are from the thought to have been from the 1560s, which is supposedly the same period as the 40-part motet Spem in Alium. And there's the whole question of which way Talis swung religiously, less clear than Burr, but managed to survive through all those different reigns from Henry VIII right up into Elizabeth. The structure of the Lamentations in the Talis is such that you get the Hebrew letters first, Aleph, Gimel, Daleph, and then the polyphony. But I'm going to play you quite an intriguing one now. This is just a little bit from an American group called Aperi Animam, which is Open Your Soul, with Daniel Koplitz. And it's not actually, I think you can find the recording on their website, but it hasn't been released. But I'm going to let my PhD student, Ben Maloney, just put it in context for us.
A few notes about this recording. The group you hear is Aperi Animam, a non-profit ensemble based in Milwaukee, Wisconsin, now celebrating its 7th anniversary. This recording was done during one afternoon in 2019 in a church with a bubbling baptismal font, hence the atmospheric water noises in the background. At the time, the group was under the direction of its founder, my friend Daniel Koplitz, who is now undertaking doctoral research at Stanford University and directing a group named Affection. The choir here was made up of 12 young singers, all of whom had recently completed bachelor's degrees in performance. The extracts are taken from a larger concert meditation called Libra Nos, a reflection on the Christian, Jewish and Muslim people murdered in mass shootings in the year leading up to the recording. The Lamentations were therefore read not as a melancholy dirge, but as a wailing outcry in the face of injustice, and this led to a rather more urgent approach to the tempo. In preparation, each ensemble member read the entire chapter from which Tallis sourced his text. A notable feature is the use of 16th century English Latin, reconstructed here by linguist Joseph Crollo, who was actually singing with the ensemble. Instead of modifying the vowels in a manner rooted in habits from their classical voice training, the group instead decided to start with a blank slate and to experiment with fresh approaches to diction. This necessitated a flexible attitude to vocal technique, including elements such as tongue position, and perhaps more controversially, the height of the larynx, perhaps a topic for another day. We know from historical documentation that Tudor musicians valued the ability to vowel well. For this recording, the group chose to abandon traditional notions of matching target vowels and to instead focus on formant tuning. This involves adjusting the vowel placement of each singer individually in order that the formants line up better. This is particularly interesting to me since it is a technique utilised by barbershop quartets to create their characteristic ring. In the barbershop world, it was named resonance matching by its pioneer, piano technician Scott Kitzmiller. The idea is that my R vowel shape in father, for example, might sound perceptually the same as anybody else's, at least within my voice, but it actually has a different acoustic signature because my vocal tract is a different shape and size. If I was singing with someone who had a darker voice than me, say, my or might actually be a better match to their R. This may sound bizarre and counterintuitive, but it works, and the effect here is that the consonances sound nicely locked together, expanded, and rich in overtones.
Thank you.
Judah has gone into exile because of affliction and hard servitude. She dwells now among the nations, but finds no resting place. Her pursuers have all overtaken her in the midst of her distress. And then the letter, Daleth. Sammy, how do you react to that?
Well, it's interesting, isn't it? We're so used to hearing that music sung, perhaps in inverted commas, beautifully. There's a definite reflection of the harshness of the text, I think, in the way in their vocal approach. I started off when it started. I thought I'm not sure about this, but actually I grew to be convinced by it. Ultimately, it's really well tuned, which I think is worth our thinking about. What did you make of it, Victoria?
Yeah, I think that sort of plaintive, sort of lament, lyric, dirge things that we were talking about earlier comes through. Yeah, quite effective, stirring.
It's recorded in, I think he said, a Baptist church, and you can hear the font gurgling away. It seems to be an active font, like an active volcano. And I mean, as singers, we all know, because you're a keen singer, Victoria, we all know the pleasure of singing Taliesin Byrd and those composers where sound and dissonance is very specifically used. And that, I mean, that is a barbershop approach at the end there with that really dirty major minor cadence. Talis's particular signature of having the minor third in the bottom and the major third at the top, which is the wrong way round for the harmonic series to make that dissonant sound nice. And he just loves it. And they really, really play it. I also hear a choir that has really lived with that work. They haven't put that together in an afternoon. They've spent weeks learning at it and getting it into their bones.
Yeah, that's something that I sort of reflected upon. It sounded, even though it's a live performance, it sounds very lived in, doesn't it? It sounds lots of unity and kind of uniformity of approach is really convincing and quite compelling.
I love that. I love the idea that music gets into you. That's another interest that I have about the embodiment of music, and particularly in the kind of polyphonic era, this kind of music. When I've sung this kind of music, it kind of does something to you as a singer being in it. I think that's just fascinating. And I often wonder, did they know what they were doing, Byrd and Talis? Did they understand the effect of this music on the human body and how it made you feel? So for me, it's always about the meaning of music, but also the sort of affect of being in this music and actually singing it.
I think that's absolutely brilliant. I'm currently, as I was just mentioning to you, Victoria, currently involved in a St. John Passion project with Professor Bettina Favi, who's at Cambridge, who I hope you'll come into contact with. You're talking absolutely her language there. She's a music professor, particularly in the early modern era, so the Baroque era. But she's very far as I can tell, from the sort of academic historical approach that we think about. She knows all that stuff, but it's much more about the effect on the bodies and the physicality of the music and the making, and the how a dissonance might sting, how a consonant chord might feel like a warm bath. Lots of sort of bodily functions that I think, like as you say, I think it's fascinating to speculate how these composers would have viewed that, and whether they were conscious of all this, all the effects they were having.
And there's the whole question of, you know, the composer does that, but then it's immediately given over to the singers, isn't it? And I'm remembering what our friend Beata Eichert says, Sammy, about when I was talking to him about Purcell. The reason he was able to do his Alehouse project, he said, is because he didn't have the hang-ups that English performers have about their own repertoire. And the other thing I think is that there is a pleasure in the sound. And if you think there should, you know, I sometimes get cross about this because I think the music is so much more than the sound, but you can't say it isn't there. And this group have just lived through the sound. Now, so that it becomes a sort of, you know, the affect of the sound speaks volumes for the music behind the piece. That's something I always think Byrd is brilliant at. Byrd will do all his little madrigalisms. He will take one word and set it with a rise or a fall, implying the individual word. But what he does is he gets the overall feeling behind the whole sense of the piece. However, his lamentations aren't nearly as good as Talis's, I think. You know, whoever does the Byrd lamentations, I mean, they're brilliant to sing, but they don't have that same listening effect on an audience. Look, we talked about the body. We should go on to Buxtehude then, because so this is what, another 115 years later, 5 years before Bach is born. And he writes his cantata of the limbs of Jesus, the membra Jesu nostri patientibus sanctissima, the limbs most holy of our suffering Jesus. And this piece was not dedicated to a priest or to a duke of somewhere. It was dedicated to an organist, which I think is a beautiful thing. And it's for five singers, a couple of violins, a consort of viols mysteriously appear in the middle. But each of the movements, each of the sections, cantatas, is dedicated to a different part of the body.
Victoria, can you tell us about that? It feels like, in my ignorant state, it feels like a particularly Catholic approach to the suffering Christ, this isolation and even objectification of particular parts of the body. Can you talk around that a bit?
Yeah, that's interesting. I think you could say that. You could say that sort of attention to an embodied approach to faith. You could call that a more Catholic response, I think. A sort of attentiveness to what these hands are, these hands, the hands of Christ, this body, the body, that kind of parallel between your body and the body of Christ, which is such a sort of central image for the life of the church. So there are sort of theologians who reflect a lot on this. Teresa of Avila, I think, is no hands but your hands. These are my hands, are your hands, in a reflection to God. So I kind of get that response.
Her children and Victoria's nephew went to the same school or something, because they're both from Avila, aren't they? Let's hear the text. Let's hear the text.
Sorry, I thought you meant this Victoria. You mean,
oh, yes.
Thomas, yeah, the composer.
Thomas Lewis de Victoria. That could have been very confusing.
That really blew my mind for a second.
Right, here's the text we're going to hear. And these are very continuous cantatas, so we're going to have to leave it in the middle. But what you hear here are, what are those wounds, plague, and Buxtehude uses this really biting suspension at that moment. What are those wounds in the midst of your hands? And then for the solo soprano, hail Jesus, wearied in agony, tormented on the cross, your sacred hands stretched out.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am, but Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Wow!
Nice!
Yeah!
What you're hearing are the sounds of people everywhere putting on Bombas socks, underwear, and T-shirts made from absurdly soft materials that feel like plush clouds. Yeah, that plush. And the best part? For every item you purchase, Bombas donates another to someone facing homelessness.
Bombas, big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST, code ACAST.
That was Philippe Pierlot and the Richard consort with soprano Maria Keohane. I think that's an amazing piece. I mean, if you don't know the whole set of the Buxtehude, check them out. We did them recently, well, last year. And they're extraordinary. You can absolutely no surprise that Bach walks 200 miles, takes months off work to go and hear Buxtehude play. He's not, I don't think he's box office gold by any means, Buxtehude, but absolutely great composer and absolutely part of that early German Baroque tradition from which Bach comes out. Just a quick mention for some excellent previous podcasts around Bach's passions. With Amy and myself talking about those, and also a quick supplication. This seems like a seasonal idea. If you would like to listen ad-free, bung us a bit of cash on Patreon. It's hugely appreciated. It makes a big difference to what we're able to do with the podcast. So if you enjoy it, and if you like your choral music, please do feel free to give either generously or meanly.
Especially in Lent. And I find those adverts really, really irritating because I'm too mean to pay for it on Patreon. So I always listen on Acast. And I really, really don't want the ads there. So do feel free to go to patreon.com/choralchihuahua and check us a couple of quid.
What do you reckon to that Buxtehude, Victoria?
Yeah, fantastic. I was trying to just check if I got the right Teresa, but I had got the right Teresa. There's that lovely prayer. The one I was coming to mind about the body is she's kind of saying, there is no body on earth, but these hands are your hands, O Christ, and this body is your body. And I look on the world with your eyes. So that's what came to mind when I was thinking about that sort of embodied stuff about this music.
And that sort of seems to link into what you were saying earlier about Lent being a kind of embodiment of Christ's trials in the desert, right? Where we kind of take on the mantle of persecution, I suppose.
Yeah, the sort of entering into a wilderness experience, being kind of tested and testing ourselves and being sure about who we are, that fits into that kind of aesthetic really well. I mean, in reality, you know, Christians aren't going out into the wilderness for 40 days, and it's a sort of figurative, a metaphor, really, for what we're doing.
In fact, I was in Jerusalem a while back, and I had a fantastic tour guide who was full of brilliant stuff. But he was saying that we were just, you know, in the middle of Jerusalem, and he was saying that what they call in the gospel the desert is actually not terribly far away. You can see it from Jerusalem. It's just It's just sort of over the Kedron Brook. So it felt to me like it wasn't the desert so much as a sort of metaphorical or kind of existential signifier, really.
Yeah, exactly. And if you've been to the Holy Land, you'll know that actually the geographic area we're talking about throughout the scriptures is actually tiny. So, it's kind of like me going to, Scarborough, and it probably even less distance than that for a wilderness experience.
Scarbados, as they call it up here. It's the holiday definition of choice. Hugh Keat, my great thinker colleague, tells me that, you know, the choice of 40 days for Lent, 40 has a particular symbolism in Hebrew culture. It just means a lot. And this idea of 40 days and Tallis writing for 40 voices, which is not particularly a Lenten piece, but is that right? Or has he just invented that? I always believe Hugh.
Well, I think there's something in that. I mean, the sort of symbol of 40 days goes right back through the scriptures. So to the people of Israel in the wilderness, eating manna. So when we come to Jesus in the wilderness, it's obvious they were going to pick up on that symbolism in the 40 days. So I think there is something in that it is a significant period of time and testing. So I think you could interpret it in that way. And of course, actual Lent for us today, we say it's 40 days, it's around 6 weeks, but we take out Sundays because Sundays are always a festival. So it's the timing, it's just quite a long time of reflection before Easter.
My wife comes from a French Catholic family, and they have days where they don't have to. Is it fish on Fridays, or are they allowed certain things that tell us about that?
Well, it's a little bit so for the Christian, Easter is always a sort of connected to a Sunday feast. So every Sunday through the year is always a little Easter. We actually reflect this in York every week. Every Friday in York is a little bit like a Good Friday. Every Saturday is a little bit like a sort of Holy Saturday. Every Easter is a little bit like every Sunday is a bit like an Easter day. So in Lent, even the Lenten fasting and penitence can't negate the joy of remembering Easter. So on Sundays, despite the kind of paring down of the liturgies, in terms of your own fast and your own kind of journey through Lent, you're allowed a little bit of a relaxation. So technically you could drink a glass of champagne on a Sunday.
I wanted to ask Sammy about an evangelist thing, because supposedly the sparsest time of the year for solo tenors is the busiest time of the year in one way, in that you are rushing around singing St. John Passions and Matthew Passions, and even throwing in the odd Messiah, which seems a strange turn of phrase. But what's it like, Sammy? How do you keep your stamina up? You had a busy week last week, and it's not getting any quieter, is it?
Yeah, it's always a busy time. I mean, I always think it's not. It's instructive to remember that it's just singing and it's just music. So it's not, I'm not doing brain surgery. So it is tiring, but it's an incredible, and having done it now for best part of 25 years, it's an incredible privilege, to spend time with that music, with that story, with what different people bring to those stories and to those arias, for example. I do passions that are just 4 or 8 singers, and then passions with, 50 or 100 people in the choir. And the fact that the music can kind of absorb and is malleable in a way that reflects that, I think there's something very profoundly expressive just even about that fact. Musically, it's my favourite part of the year. I think there is no greater music than those passion settings liturgically. But I also love the way that perhaps Victoria can talk more about this, more eloquently at least about this than me, but the way that this Christian story, the facets of the story kind of ripple out so far beyond, the relatively limited Christian theology. We're talking about suffering and betrayal and letting your friends down and love And that amazing moment, for example, where Christ on the cross tells Mary to look after John and tells John to look after Mary. These are things that I just find completely moving within Christianity or not.
Absolutely. And I think that's, that's the joy of this season, that you hear some of these stories retold through significant works of music, through the Passions, through Messiah. And I think they're, in a sense, they're human stories, aren't they? These are human stories within the context of the Christian church, of a divine story. So I think I've seen throughout my ordained career and my sort of musical life, seeing these stories connect to people in the most profound ways. People who've had no experience of church or Christianity, somehow these musical narrations of this amazing story bring people in.
That's exactly right. And the way that music is able to kind of pile meaning upon words, you know, we understand the story of the Passion even if we don't speak German, for example, yeah, in an incredibly instinctive and visceral and profound existential way.
Yeah. I don't know if you've ever sung James Macmillan's St. Luke's Passion, which is a fascinating piece in many ways because of the way he interprets the evangelist and Christ speaking. But in that, he references the bark, St. Matthew. The first time I sang that piece, you hear the bark coming through. I burst into tears because it's kind of, he as a contemporary composer is layering and layering even more onto it. So he's referencing the bark, and he's a devout Roman Catholic. So that's all coming through. So it kind of hits you when you're listening to this music, the depth of the meaning and the resonance of the meaning in these passions is really incredible.
We were talking about, or we were discussing beforehand about 21st century settings of music for Lent. And we were coming up with some, but not obviously nothing like the number that you do for Christmas or for Easter, times of rejoicing. Yet if you think of 16th century settings, we all think about the glorious sad pieces. You know, we could all list 40 Renaissance pieces we wanted at our funeral, but not necessarily at our marriage. At my marriage, I had the Hippopotamus Song as the congregational hymn. I do recommend that. But you've just mentioned Macmillan, and of course his Miserere, with that extraordinary ending. I mean, we could so easily have played that today. I do encourage people to go and listen to the Miserere. It's a fantastic piece. It really packs a punch at the end, as so often with Macmillan.
I've never really understood, sorry to interrupt, I've never really understood how that is quite so effective. Is it? It feels almost like a folk song. I don't think it is a folk song. But that kind of homophonic stuff at the end, that, like you say, is absolutely overwhelming in context.
I'm just remembering the late Steve Wright here, who said that you can't talk about something you're not then going to show. So we're going to tell everyone to go out and James Macmillan Miserere. But for now, Victoria, you've come up with a really recent piece that was commissioned for the 16 to finish us off today. Tell us about this.
Yeah, it's Dobrynka Tabakova, Turn Our Captivity, O Lord, which was commissioned for the 16's choral pilgrimage. And it's basically picking up on the text of the bird anthem of the same name, the words from Psalm 126. I don't think it was specifically written for Lent, but given everything we've talked about, I think it fits with the tone of Lenten music really well. It's very simple. It's very, there is a sort of a little thread of hope running through it. And it also picks up on the language of turning, which I think is so significant in this season. So it's kind of pleading that captivity is turned to freedom, which if you think about the journey through Lent, fits that really well.
I was just going to say that's the central message of that central chorale in the John Passion, where everything sort of flows out the mirror. That's the final payoff line, is if you hadn't gone through your imprisonment talking to Christ, then our imprisonment would have been eternal. And that sense of captivity through this period becoming freedom and allowing us to access our own spiritual freedom, I suppose, is absolutely central part of the season.
It's a few days since I've listened to this, so I can't remember whether she does quote the bird at the beginning, because the bird starts turn, and then the tenor part turns it on its head and goes turn, lovely turning idea. So this is the 16 with Harry Christophers, and someday someone will write a book about the commissions they've made over the years for their amazing choral pilgrimage thing, which is something still happening. It's not getting any easier for them, I think, but it's still happening. And there's a book about all the pieces the King Singers have commissioned as well over the years. They should be available somewhere for other groups to look at. Fantastic body of work. Victoria, thank you very much for giving us the benefit of your experience on all this. And our next episode, coming out 2 weeks, will be about Tenebrae, where we won't invite you to be talking because it'll be far too confusing with Victoria, who we're going to feature on. Thanks very much.
Thank you.
Return Our Captivity by Dobrinka Tabakova, recorded on the 16's album A Watchful Gaze. They do this album that comes out with the Choral Pilgrimage every year, and this one has an owl looking out. The owl is a bird, I suppose. Lots of bird on the album as well. Dobrinka Tabakova, Bulgarian-born but now living in the UK, lots of orchestral music as well. You should look her up. So that's it till next time, when we'll be looking at Tenebrae, including a new Fagiolini album. If you still buy CDs, do look it up, because it's got an extra that you can only get on the album, some rather extraordinary poetry by Christopher Reed from his collection, A Scattering. So we will see you next time. It just remains for me to remind you at the end of the episode that if you could pop over to patreon.com/ Choral Chihuahua, if you can spell Chihuahua, and frankly, which of us can? I think it's H-U-A-H-U-A. Support us for £3 a month. That will be terribly helpful. Sorry to keep going on about it. We're not very good at this, the Brits, are we, asking for money? But we're trying not to lose so much money doing the podcasts. Cheers. Just before you go, another reminder to try listening on Patreon, which costs just a few pounds per month. Or, if you prefer, you can very simply make a one-off donation. You can actually do either via choralchihuahua.com. Thanks.